Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Have you ever searched for a deed to a property or tried to obtain a marriage license or researched your family history or history of where you live? After being founded in the 1680s and being one of the original 13 American colonies, Pennsylvania is one of the nation's oldest states and has the records that go along with that long history. But as these records age, how are they preserved? That's what we're talking about on today's Smart Talk, preserving historical documents. Maybe some are more historic than others, but preserving documents. Joining us on the program is Barbara Bartos, who is the Cumberland County Archivist. Mr. Bartos, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Also joining us, Andrew Dalton, Adams County Historical Society's Assistant Collections Manager. Mr. Dalton, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
And we're joined on the phone by Jesse Crooks, a librarian at the Mercer Museum in Bucks County. Ms. Crooks, welcome to the show.
Mr. Crooks, thank you.
All right. And if you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@wytf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Barbara Bartos, I'm going to start with you. We decided to pursue this topic after hearing that Cumberland County got a grant to preserve documents. First of all, how much was the grant?
It's a $15,000 grant from PHMC's Records Care Grant Program, and then the county, Cumberland County, has matched that with $15,000.
PHMC, Pennsylvania Historic and Museum Commission. So with that money, $15,000 that is then matched, what is that money used to do?
We're going to focus on colonial civil court cases that go from 1761 to 1776. It's part of a larger project because we're going to do all the way from 1750 to 1776. But the grant is going to focus just on that 61 to 76 period. And basically, we're going to be cleaning them, inventorying them, profiling them, folderizing them in better protection, and then eventually we're going to be scanning them as a backup preservation and then putting them on the web for people to see them.
So all the original documents will be preserved?
Not all of them, because not all of them are there. Some of them have been lost for a variety of reasons, but we're not going to know that until we've inventoried them. Right now they're folded up, tri-folded. They were in metal bins, originally probably in wooden bins. So we don't know exactly what's there until we unfold them. And you only want to touch them a limited number of times. So it'll be one at a time that we're going to address the different steps in preserving them better.
When you say touch them, how do you touch them?
Carefully.
I'll give you that. But, wearing gloves or just how?
We don't use gloves. If you were in a museum and you're dealing with objects, I certainly recommend that. But for the records we have from this particular period, they're very dry, they're very brittle, they're very fragile. Some of them are in fragments. And those gloves tend to actually be more cumbersome. You just make sure your hands are clean and they're dry, you're working in a clean space. But we have found that actually, and there are several ways that you can turn records over that are fragile, but the gloves just seem to be more of a detriment than protecting them at this point.
Mr. Crooks, you're a librarian at the Mercer Museum in Bucks County. First of all, for those here in central Pennsylvania who aren't familiar with the Mercer Museum, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, the Mercer Museum itself is a really wonderful institution. It looks like a kind of a castle. It was built by Henry Mercer using a unique cement casting technique. So it's a really interesting building. We're actually operated by the Bucks County Historical Society. We run the Mercer Museum. We also run a historic house museum called Font Hill, both in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. And in our archive, we're the repository for all of the early Bucks County records as well.
Mm-hmm. So you just heard what Barbara Bartos said about using gloves in a museum setting. Is it any different when you're handling these documents?
Yeah. So the we have kind of distinct sections in our institution. So for there are certainly reasons one would wear gloves when dealing with objects. But yeah, I'm on the same page with when handling documents. Really, you want bare hands, and you develop a lot of specific techniques. For example, you know, if you are scanning something on a flatbed scanner, the easiest way to pick it up is to slip a piece of printer paper underneath it in order to gently lift it instead of trying to use your fingers to grip the edge. When we have damaged documents, we'll interleave them with, you know, say with our fragments, we'll interleave them with paper that's intact so that the pieces are held together well. And, you know, you minimize the damage to it in various ways, but really having clean, bare hands is the best way to do it.
And I'm going to ask all three of you this question, but Jesse Crooks, in Bucks County, one of the reasons that we wanted to have someone from Bucks County on the program is because of William Penn, and there has to be some documents in Bucks County from William Penn, and we're talking about documents that go back over 300 years. Obviously, age probably has an impact on how you handle something. But from a personal perspective, are there some documents that you look at and say, "Ooh, I really have to be careful with this one"?
Absolutely, and it's not necessarily even age as much as it is the condition or the level of degeneration. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the older the document, the longer it's had to degenerate in some way. But there are, you know, a lot really. The older documents from the 1700s or 1800s are often in much better condition than some documents that were made after they started using more acidic paper. So if you look at a newspaper from 1920, it's probably going to be in much worse shape than, you know, a handwritten document from 1750. The really old stuff, you know, we certainly have some issues with. The ink that they actually used to write with, iron gall ink, actually causes the paper to degenerate. It can under certain conditions eat away at it, and so on certain documents you'll even have where they started, you know, how they often would use a much larger letter to start a text, that might, where there's denser ink, it can actually eat away in the shape of the letter, you know, you see a lot of different degeneration, especially in our documents from the 1600s.
Mm. Andrew Dalton, I see. Well, both of you are nodding your heads in agreement. But in Gettysburg, I mean, not that the other counties don't have historic documents, but Gettysburg, Adams County, obviously has some documents that are nationally, if not internationally, that there's interest. When you're nodding your head, again, these documents, because there is so much interest out there and they are such a historic nature, are you thinking about that as you're handling these documents?
Right, Scott, that's a really great point. It actually reminds me of an experience I had very early in my time at the Society. Like all other repositories, we often go through boxes that haven't been organized in decades, if not longer. And there was an instance where I was actually looking through a box of mathematical equations done on scrap paper, basically, by some student in Adams County. And one of the documents, as I was turning them over, turned out to be a program from the Gettysburg Address. And these programs are exceptionally rare. I think I've looked at other online catalogs, and there are probably less than 5 or 10 in existence. But one of them was just being used as scrap paper by this student. And we didn't know we had that document, actually, until a couple of years ago, because it was just mixed into this larger collection that hadn't been properly processed.
So it would have been very easy to have missed that.
Right. Yeah. And that's the real great thing about working at a small local historical society, is that you can work with materials like that where you have no idea what you're going to find or come across. So that's just one experience that I've had that I think is probably a common trend in other institutions.
Obviously, the student who was doodling on the program didn't realize that there would be some significance to that years later, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, stuff like that is just, it's common, but it's always a pleasure to be able to find something like
I'm
that.
I'm curious, what did the program to the Gettysburg Address look like?
Right, so it's a document, it's on blue paper, and it has the procession basically the order of the procession to the cemetery. So it says President of the United States, and then secretaries of the cabinet, followed by like a military body, and then, you know, anyone else who was part of the parade, local organizations, local groups, and then it lists the order for the speakers. So Edward Everett was the keynote speaker, obviously, and a famous orator of the time who spoke for over 2 hours,
right,
and then
right.
followed by the President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, who spoke for just 2 minutes. But to have a program, even though it's doodled on, is just a great way to connect people to that event, whether we have it on display or we actually do a hands-on program with original documents where we have them encased, and we actually pass them around and let people interact with the actual documents and hold a piece of history, which I think is a really great experience.
Is that on display, that program on display?
Not right now. We actually we use it for special programs right now, but we're hoping to open a museum in the next few years where we can have it on display.
So, Barbara, let me go back to you, and I'm jumping around. I'll warn you ahead of time because of the way our conversation goes. But is this costly? I mean, $15,000 doesn't sound like a whole lot of money, but probably for a county that, you know, you're looking for money and the county has to match the money, is this a costly proposition to be able to preserve these documents?
Depends on what you mean by costly.
Yeah, I guess that's a relevant term, isn't it?
The supplies that we need are not just from Staples. You have to get specialized archival acid-free type of materials. And it depends on the resources that an institution has. You have to decide how far you can go. What is costly is the hands to do the work. It's very time-consuming, as I'm sure the other gentleman will attest, to look at these documents, to study them, analyze them, to profile them, to do any kind of 101 cleaning. It's very time-consuming. Most of the grant that we're going to receive is going to go towards hiring another person to focus just on these 1761 to 1776 documents.
When you say documents have to be cleaned, how are they cleaned?
This is where I think every archivist has a heart in their line in their heart. Sorry. And it's basically, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have the skill. It belongs to a conservator. So I can only go so far. We do what I call basic 101 cleaning. And it's basically unfolding them, because when they're folded up, especially when they're dry and brittle, it weakens the fibers, and then they'll split apart. So then you'll have fragments. We use a particular type of, it's a bag that has eraser shavings in them, I guess. And you can very, very gently go over the top of the document, and it'll pick up surface dirt. When you get to the part with mold and old Scotch tape that's horrible, cringing, although at the time, I give people a little leeway. At the time when Scotch tape came out, we have an advertisement for it, how wonderful it was. It was at the time.
I don't think you have to worry about that in 1761, though.
No, I meant when other people
I understand. I'm just saying that the Scotch tape didn't come along probably until the 1900s.
Oh, thank you for making that quite clear. But there's a point after that that I just say to myself, no, this is a conservator's job. Mm-hmm. I'm not a conservator. That's a very specialized field with techniques. You have to know chemistry and all kinds of things. I'm a generalist, so 101 cleaning is as far as I go.
Jesse Crooks, what about that in Bucks County?
Yeah, I think we're pretty much in the same boat there. First off, I have to interject about the Scotch tape. There was some very well-intentioned county employee at some point who did tape up quite a bit of our documents before we received them. And for those of you, for the listeners that aren't familiar with what Scotch tape does over time, the acid from the tape leaches into the documents and ends up kind of burning a line where there's like a kind of brown line where the tape adhesive used to adhere to the document. The tape falls off, so you end up with fragments anyway, but it in some cases can actually make the text completely illegible, or at least more difficult to read. I do, however, try to make myself feel better when I see that Bucks County Records by telling myself that they did the same thing as the Dead Sea Scrolls in the 1950s. But yeah, we're not conservators. We're archivists, and so we try to preserve in place. We'll do things like try to stabilize documents, mostly rehousing, where we take the document, make sure it's stored in a way that it's physically safe without making any fundamental changes to it. But we certainly have some stuff that is in need of conservation, and we have stuff that has been conserved. One of the most interesting things in our collection is what they call the Book of Arrivals. It dates back to 1684, and it's really kind of, it's technically a few separate books that were rebound as a single volume. So it has, the earliest wills and administrations from the county. It has a marriage list, and it's called the Book of Arrivals because William Penn instructed each county to compile a list of every family that came over and settled in their county, along with various information about their family, about their servants, and so on. I believe Bucks County might be the only one that actually went through with it and made that list, but that's why it's called the Book of Arrivals. But that book was, from the 1600s, had suffered over the years, and they actually did a really interesting conservation treatment to it, where they disassembled the book, separated out the individual leaves of paper, and then used this process where they kind of put it on a screen and submerge it in liquid paper pulp, and then pull it out. And basically, what that does is when it dries, it reconstitutes the page so that there any holes have been eaten into it or torn out of it are reconstituted with paper, and it kind of gives you an extra edge around the paper to kind of have a page edge that's intact if it was kind of fragmentary, and then they rebound it together as a book again. And we have some other things that could use the same kind of treatment, but that's the kind of thing that we would never be able to do on site, and you probably need a grant, and definitely need a highly trained conservator to do that kind of work.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Before we get back to the program, I want to remind you of some programs that we have coming up. We'll be talking with members of the Pennsylvania State Animal Response Team that rescues animals in emergencies. We'll be talking about foster care in Pennsylvania and a D-Day road trip to the Eisenhower Farm in Gettysburg on June 6th. And if you'd like to join us for that, you could go to WITF.org/events. But if you want to look ahead to some of the topics that we'll be covering over the next few weeks, go to WITF.org/smarttalk. You can actually leave a voice memo or a voice mail that if you maybe can't call in during the program itself, that we can use on the air. But those are some of the programs that we're looking forward to here in the next few weeks. On today's program, we're talking about preserving historic documents. One of the things we will discuss during the show, we'll talk about how you can preserve some of your own documents. I'm sure there are a lot of people out there, whether it's photographs, whether it's documents itself. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. Our guest, Jesse Crooks, a librarian at the Mercer Museum in Bucks County. Andrew Dalton, Adams County Historical Society's Assistant Collections Manager. And Barbara Bartos, Cumberland County Archivist. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. You can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Facebook, we are WIT, or I should say you can go to WITF's Facebook page and leave a question or a comment. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Barbara Bartos, you wanted to follow up on something that Jesse had said just before we left. You wanted to mention that this is something that those at home, and I wanted to bring that point out, those at home, if they want to preserve some documents or some papers or photographs, that they actually can use some of these methods, right?
And mostly we've talked about individual items, but there's also a bigger strategy, and that has to do with the entire environment where you keep all of your holdings or collections. I tend to think of it as a burglar system, that you want to keep out the bad guys that are going to compromise the longevity of your records. And the seven elements that I look at that you can control in your environment, whether it would be at our archives in Cumberland County or in one's home. I call them the seven deadly sins. There's temperature and humidity, there's light, there's bugs and rodents, there's dirt and dust and air pollution, disasters, and human beings. And each one of those, you can do something at home. Documents, paper documents particularly, do not like to have a wide swing in temperature or relative humidity, so you want to keep it kind of in a small parameter, which means basically at home, you don't want to put your documents in the attic, you don't want to put them in the basement, you don't want to put them near a radiator, because that's going to do something with the heat and the humidity that can eventually grow mold if you've got a situation like that.
Well, we have a question from Tony in Harrisburg, who is a conservator, and just wanted to add in exactly what you were talking about. Tony, you're on the air.
I'm sorry, I didn't. I didn't want to get the delay, so I was on a speaker. Hey, no, I was just going to say I get asked every day. I do stuff from the 1500s to the 1890s, and I get asked probably once every 2 weeks, what should I do with this stuff at home? And if any of your listeners are asking the same question, the rule of thumb that I use for people, not just me, is to keep it as close. The default is something like an air-conditioned room, you know, relative humidity of 70% or so and a temperature of somewhere in the 60s or 70s. But I just say as close as you can get it to an air-conditioned room is the place to keep this stuff. And keep it out of the sun and keep it away from heat. That's all I have to say.
All right, Tony, thank you very much for your call.
I'd add to the other one, you want it in a clean space. You don't want to eat around them.
Yeah, that's probably not a good idea.
Yeah, some of it is just common sense.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
You can spend a lot of money and go and get a conservator or do some other things, but the simple things are the best. Keep it clean, folks.
Right.
We had another question here from Mary in Harrisburg. Andrew, I'll direct this one to you. Wanted to know what you do about protecting these documents from fire, because we know that over the years that there have been fires at let's face it, that's how people heated their homes. How they heated a lot of these buildings was with fireplaces,
right.
And a lot of documents have been lost over the years due to fire. What do you do to protect your collection against fire?
Unfortunately, there's not a lot we can do because we're actually in a very old building that's not well equipped for protecting against fire, but a lot of more modern repositories actually have fire safety mechanisms, fire walls, fire doors to protect and kind of contain any incidents with fire. So we're actually hoping to, in the next few years, have a new facility in Adams County where we can have some of these more modern and more protective measures inside our building.
Does it worry you that you're not up, you don't have these protections right
It does,
now.
Yes. And I think that kind of speaks to a larger issue about local history. A lot of county historical societies are in the same place that we're in terms of funding and having to kind of exist in buildings that are not extremely well equipped for old documents, 100-year-old documents, 200-year-old documents. And so that's why I think it's just so important that people remember that, you know, giving to your local historical society is just an essential way to make sure that your community's history is preserved and protected.
Jesse Crooks, do you have fire protection?
Yeah, we have two you know, kind of modern archival vaults that have climate control and all that. Of course, every institution should have plans in place in case there is a fire or any other disaster, you know, whether it's a leak or what have you. But, you know, we're in a pretty safe building ourselves. The building itself is made of cement, partly because Henry Mercer, who designed it, he came up with his kind of crazy cement castle building technique in order to make fireproof buildings. So we're probably pretty good on the fire front. I'd be more worried about leaks or other sort of natural disasters.
Which we do know that there have been documents that either have been destroyed or damaged, greatly damaged, because of water. All right, so I'm going to ask the three. Go ahead.
I have 2 points. Number one, Cumberland County, we only deal with government records. We did have a fire, 1845, where the courthouse was burned, and so we have lost a lot of records. But I think all of us are very happy that there are so many that records that have left. The other is Cumberland County did invest a lot of money in the building we're in, and we do have fire suppression. But again, if for homes, you got to be as clean as you can. Make sure you don't leave those fire hazards around or your documents near them. We also have temperature humidity control. We have security. Cumberland County really invested in its responsibility to take care of these records.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask the three of you, and we're getting a lot of calls and emails, so I want to get to those too. But I'm going to ask the three of you, oldest, maybe most valuable document that you have in your collections. And Jesse, I'll start with you. Oldest and most valuable.
In terms of the government records, so as one of the original three counties in Pennsylvania, our records actually go back to 1683. And so we have some orphans court records from that date. We have a court book from that date. And then starting in 1684, we have quite a bit. And so that first few years of Pennsylvania's history, that I think is some of the most valuable stuff that we have. In terms of numerical value, I couldn't really give you that.
Oh, no, I'm not, and really, I'm not looking for that. But I'm curious, and I sound like a fanboy here, but so, Jesse, have you actually touched documents that were touched by William Penn?
Yeah, most of it was made locally. We actually had a single person who authored most of the original records. He held, like, five different positions of local government back when the county wasn't populated enough to have separate staff in those positions. So most of what we have was actually from the 1600s, actually written by a man named Phineas Pemberton.
Phineas, okay.
We do have at least one deed in the collection. Of course, the county wasn't in the business of keeping original deeds, so it wouldn't normally have been something that would have been kept, but we have a deed that William Penn signed and has I think it's like a ceramic kind of seal that's hanging from it from a ribbon. I'm sure we have other stuff from that William Penn would have been involved with, but that's the one artifact that I saw recently that comes to mind.
Now, does an archivist, I'm just curious, as someone who is a history buff, does an archivist get those kind of chills that when you touch something that maybe William Penn has touched or something that has historic significance, do you think to yourself and actually take that step back and say, oh, I can't believe what I'm holding or what I'm seeing?
Yeah, for me, it's less about super famous people or something like that, and more documents that kind of speak to the lives of common people. Really, I mean, when you have something that reveals something that would have otherwise been lost because it's dealing with people that would have otherwise been marginalized, I find that a lot more interesting. So, for example, we recently received a treasurer's account book from the county in a recent deposit that dates back to 1747. And going through the document when I was cataloging it, before I figured out what it was because it was unlabeled, one of the first things I found was a list of payments for noxious animal bounties, which is people would be paid to bring in crows and squirrel heads and so on, animals that were supposedly bad for agriculture. And you see a ton of African Americans who were probably enslaved at the time, some of whom may have been free, and a bunch of Lenape names. And Native Americans that had anglicized names as well. And that I got chills looking at, because that's, there are all these people that suddenly you have a little bit of a fragment of information about them that would have otherwise been lost to history. And you find out, for example, that apparently some slave owners let their slaves collect noxious animal bounties, and that there were, even though they aren't otherwise that well documented, you had a number of Native Americans still living in the vicinity and collecting government money for, collecting these animals.
Noxious animal.
I found really interesting.
Yeah. Andrew, what about Adams County? Oldest, most valuable?
Sure. Yeah, so we have documents back to the 1730s, mostly deeds and other private papers. But since the county was founded in 1800, the bulk of our materials start in 1800 and go up through the present day. A couple really amazing things we have. We have a document signed by Francis Scott Key from 1831. Key was actually a member of the bar in Adams County. He was a lawyer, but lived in Washington, D.C., and in 1831 he traveled to Gettysburg Pittsburgh and actually brought with him a slave and freed the slave at the courthouse in the center of the square of Gettysburg. And we have the manumission document. The slave's name was Clem Johnson. We don't really know what happened to him after that, but it's just a fascinating piece, and I get chills when I hold that. And that really speaks to, we've actually recently, Jesse mentioned a second ago about marginalized communities and working to try to present their history. We just recently have been working on a database for all of the black citizens buried in the Lincoln Cemetery in Gettysburg, which is the only black cemetery in Adams County. And actually half of the people buried in that cemetery, over half, do not have a headstone. And so we've actually pieced together records from all these different places, and we put it all together into a database. And it's really the only lasting way for us to record these individuals as having been buried there. It's kind of a way to honor their memory when we don't have other sources available to do so. So we have that. And then if I can mention one more thing.
Sure.
During the Battle of Gettysburg, obviously, you know, Adams County had about 30,000 citizens. The town of Gettysburg had about 2,400, and many of those people left behind written reminiscences, diary entries, journals, newspaper articles about their experiences during the Civil War and during the battle. So we actually have a large collection, over 200 civilian accounts of the battle, and so we can actually study and understand what it was like to live in Gettysburg or in Adams County during the Battle of Gettysburg.
You know, it is, and just what Jesse said and what you said, Andrew, I think that, you know, many times very early on, historians looked at what the generals, the famous people, had to say.
Yep.
But nowadays, when I say nowadays, it seems like this has just been just an observation in the last 20 years or so, that historians and people are more interested in what the people living through that, the regular people, the citizens of Gettysburg, had to say or wrote about it. You can learn a lot more maybe from, because let's face it, there's spin put on it even in 1863 as opposed to make yourself look a little bit better.
Yeah.
So Barbara, what about Cumberland County? Oldest, most valuable?
Cumberland County was founded in 1750, and as a government archive, we do not have anything prior to 1750. As far as, you know, what gives me a thrill, I agree with the gentleman that it's not just those important people that you have records associated with. We were fortunate to have many records that have survived for this grant we're doing, where three signers of the Declaration of Independence were lawyers when they were young practicing in Carlisle. So we have, if anyone was looking at their legal history for these three individuals.
Who are they?
James Wilson, James Smith, and George Ross, that they would want to look at these early careers and the documents and find patterns or whatever. They're not the only ones. McClay, the only reason we know so much about the Continental Congress is because of McClay's diaries. He was a Pennsylvania senator, but he was also a lawyer when he was young. Cumberland County, by the way, used to go all the way to Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
So we have records for a lot of other counties, and they're not just transferred over to that county when it's formed. We have, as an example that the like the other gentleman used, we have fortunately the slave registers and the slave returns for Cumberland County, almost all of them, which is just wonderful. And that's important. That's a big subject that people are very, very interested in. But when they were cataloged in the beginning, no one took the time to really look at the registers. And in the back, people were very frugal in the late 1700s with the paper. You know, paper you didn't go down to Staples and just get paper. And in the back, there's a section that lists the enlisted men for militia. And these would have been the everyday people. And it includes a description, the color of their hair, their height, their shoe size, because shoes had to be ordered for the enlisted men, their occupation, a lot of information. What gives me kind of thrill, it's almost like Christmas. You never know what you're going to find when you go through these boxes. And I thought, wealthy people had their portraits done. But if you were a genealogist and it just happened that your name, your family's name was in that list in the back of that slave register, what a gold mine, because there were no photographs. There were no portraits of these everyday people. So I look at them. Yes, it's great to find the important people and look at their history and their association with your area, but it is also just as important. Each document is important to somebody, and that's very difficult for an archivist to put their biases aside about what's important, what's not important, and all of them are to somebody. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Listen, tomorrow for Smart Talk, we'll be discussing, it's Army Heritage Days at the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle this weekend, and with the 75th anniversary of D-Day, that's their focus. We'll be talking about that. Also, conversation with Fred Keller, who is the Republican candidate for the House of Representatives in the 12th Congressional District. There is that special election on May 21st. 12th Congressional District covers a wide area throughout the central part of the state, including much of the WITF listening area. So Fred Keller will be a guest on tomorrow's program as well. During this program, we are talking about preserving historic documents. Our guest today on the program, Andrew Dalton, Adams County's Historical Society's Assistant Collection Manager, Barbara Bardos, a Cumberland County Archivist, and Jesse Crooks, a librarian at the Mercer Museum in Bucks County. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a call from Greg in Chambersburg. Greg, you're on the air. Hello, Greg, can you hear me? Hello, Greg? Okay, can't get Greg right now on the air, but we will hear in just a moment. Let's go to some emails. Catherine asks, for many of us as researchers, we may be searching for information online. This digitized preservation efforts, they're very important. What is the protocol for capturing images for online review, especially in terms of readability? Barbara Bardos, let me ask you that question.
Well, fortunately, the records that the government has, at least the ones we do, are public records. So there's no copyright. There are some restrictions regarding confidentiality records. But we do scan. We're working very hard at scanning our paper documents because they're one of a kind. They're unique. If something happened to them, they're gone. So we are digitalizing them, scanning them for preservation, but then we do put them online, and they are printable. The only thing about our website, you go through the Cumberland County website, www.ccpa.net, is that we are a government archive, so it's not set up like an historical society where you can do genealogy. You have to know some other information. But you can actually print off the documents we put online.
Mm. How is it decided? I guess I should ask this question several ways. But Jesse, let me ask you. Obviously, the way that documents have been preserved for the past 300 years before computers came along, it had to physically be done. I mean, you all have described that, these documents, the original documents in boxes, I'm sure it took up a lot of space. But over the years, there had to be some documents that it was decided, well, we probably are not going to need this, or this is not that significant, so it could be, I don't know, you could get rid of it. How is it decided what to keep and what not to keep?
Well, for us, I mean, we're the repository for the county, so we are not in a position to make that call with regard to any of the county documents. Once it's been deposited with us, we hold on to it. There is more of a kind of selection process as to what we hold on to. So, for example, we, with rare exceptions, don't have anything from after 1900. We got some specific things related to Prohibition and related to the Great Depression, but we kind of filter a little bit in terms of what we say we will hold on to. And, you know, we're a much easier point of public access for these documents than going through the county, although the county, you know, is required to provide access to anything because of the state's government records laws. but in general, I mean, you know, we do deaccessioning for other sorts of documents, but for the government records, we don't really do that. But in general, the way an institution would usually do that is they would decide whether the items were within the scope of their collecting mission. So, for example, if you had something that had nothing to do with your county and your county historical society, and it's something from, you know, another state, maybe you'd decide to deaccession it. But for the government records, it's not a call you have to make.
And that is something the state does regulate. That they have what counties have to permanently keep, which makes it an easy decision.
Let's take a phone call from Greg. Greg, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I have two quick conservator questions. I recently got an early Civil War local history book called The Great Invasion by Jacob Polk, and it has a slight musty smell. I was wondering if there's a way to remove that, and also on an old document, if you had someone put some ink scribbles on it from an ink pen, is there any way to lighten or remove the ink scribble? That's it.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. Both Andrew and Barbara didn't have looks on their faces like they were real optimistic about that.
No, if someone came to me with that question, as far as the book and the musty smell, I mean, you can air it out, but as far as the ink and anything else you wanted to do with that book, I'm going to be the person who says, I'm not a conservator. You need to go to somebody who really knows.
A book conservator, likely.
And are you willing to spend the money to have that done? And then are you willing to maintain the conditions and the environment so that it won't happen again? Mm. But this is the one where I would pass the buck.
Jess, you going to pass the buck too?
Oh, I mean, in terms of my opinion about that, yeah. scan it and take it out in Photoshop.
right. Yep.
Will has an email here, says, I cannot stress enough how important archival work is to preserving area history. Right. Without this information, much of our history would be horribly gapped or incomplete, potentially leading to further historical destruction. I've been trying to research the forgotten hemp industries of Cumberland County, which leads me to my two questions. Can more be done to give the public access to the information collected by the Historical Society in Cumberland County? Can more be done to archive publications put out in the past by the Cumberland County Historical Society, other organizations? Incredibly useful information to discovering local history lies in self-published books that are deteriorating, like the original source documents. I believe they should be electronically scanned like any other document. Now, Barbara, you're not with the Historical Society. You're with the county itself. But can you help Will with his answers? And I'm sure you're glad to hear that he says how important it is to preserving this.
I think kind of two points. The records, be they at the Historical Society, be they paper, three-dimensional, food, music, any kind of a document or record, does two things about history. When they're analyzed or studied, they either verify or confirm a pattern that has become part of our history, a generalization, or they show exceptions. So I'm right on with this gentleman how important these documents are and to continue to research them. As far as the Cumberland County Historical Society, they're like any other institution. They have to make priorities as far as what they are going to digitize. I know that the Cumberland County Historical Society has the Gardner Library online, and they've been working on different subjects. I know they have lots of monographs. They were founded in the 1870s, so they still have a lot of those. You might want to contact them and talk to them that there's an interest in this, and that might move it up. Their list of a type of material subject matter they might want to pursue.
My producers are always on the ball, and they just sent me Google about the musty smell. Okay, Google says, if your book is moldy and mildew free, but still has a smell to it, you can sprinkle baking soda in a sealed container or bag and place the book inside for a couple of hours. The baking soda is quite effective at absorbing the scent. Activated charcoal can be substituted in this step. So,
I think like any archivist or anyone dealing with these kind of records, if you don't feel comfortable doing that, don't do it.
Right.
Don't
no.
ruin yep. it. Don't ruin
I'd want to go don't. And talk to yep. some other people who actually mm-hmm. are conservators before I started to do that.
Right.
Andrew, you're a young guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's good looking, too.
But, well, and I say anyone younger than me is a young guy anyway.
Right.
But anyway, you're a young guy, probably in your 20s.
Yeah.
I think you were at Gettysburg College,
yeah.
right?
Yep.
Okay.
Just,
yeah. So I think what concerns a lot of people about preserving history and paying attention to history is that it doesn't seem to be on the radar for many young people.
Right.
Is it?
I think it is, but it is in different ways. I think all history is local history, and I think that young people really care about history that is important to them and in their lives. So, for instance, I've found that, you know, my peers are more interested in the history of their community, their church, their school, their family. So I'll often encounter students my age who are very interested in their own genealogy, and that can be a gateway to getting into more interest in history that's not just specific to their own family, because everyone's ancestors participated in all these historic events that we study and we learn about. And if you can actually tie your own family to important historic events, I think it creates such a more meaningful experience. And I think young people really care about that, and it's just a matter of kind of breaking through. And I think the key to that really is focusing on small institutions like ours, where a student could walk in and discover a document like a program to the Gettysburg Address.
You know, Jesse Crooks, over the years, and I'm sure we've all heard people say this, not just young people, but, you know, I wasn't really interested in history. I don't want to memorize all the dates. But what you're talking about, the three of you are talking about here, you're not talking about memorizing dates. And the reason I came to you, Jesse, is because when you talk about that arrival document that you have, I mean, with so many people who are researching their family history, I mean, that has to be so valuable to many Pennsylvanians who back in, in the 1680s came into this colony, and there are the names right there, the people that you're related to, that you're directly descended from. So I just to follow up on what Andrew was saying is that I kind of that's an observation that a lot of people, no matter how old they are, when they can tie it to themselves, it's more mm-hmm. relatable, and it's not just memorizing dates, is it?
No, yeah, I mean, I completely agree, and as a reference archivist at the library, I'll have people come in and guide them through the documents and help them find these documents about their ancestors, and the experience of learning about history through your sense of family connection is really strong, and that's really what draws a lot of people to it. And you can, provide other information when you're helping people find the genealogical information, provide context, and, that's kind of what your job is, helping people out. So, when people look up a document and all they're kind of really looking for is a name and maybe seeing who the parents were and so on, you can guide them into the kind of historical narrative by providing context and background and explaining things. Mm-hmm. And even, a lot of these records are so old that, they're from the early modern era where they had, different letters in the English language.
Yeah.
And, that alone is an interesting experience where you're explaining to someone what a long S is or how the letter thorn was retained for words like the and, shorthand usage and all that. It kind of transports people, even if they didn't come looking for that. When you have the documents in your hands, it'll bring you there.
We only have about 90 seconds left. I want to thank the three of you. This was a fascinating conversation. Real quick, amongst the three of you, what's the most unusual item? I ask about the most valuable and most popular. What's most unusual? Because it's not just documents. I mean, you actually, there's newspapers, but there's some like hard items. Anything that, Jesse, you can think of that's very unusual?
Oh, well, as a museum, we have some human remains.
That's unusual.
I'll leave it at that.
We have relics, a lot of relics discovered on the battlefield, and we have a couple sets of bullets that actually collided in the air during the Battle of Gettysburg. that we preserve our collection.
There were that many bullets flying that they collided in the air.
Exactly.
I've actually seen that before.
Right. It's amazing to hold that and
really
think about it.
It really is. Barbara, what about Cumberland County?
I'm just amazed at all the variety of topics that are recorded in government documents. Probably the one that took my breath away was when I found the genealogy to a pedigree pig that was raised at the poorhouse. And it's a certificate showing, I can't remember what you call the grandparents and grandparents of a pedigree pig. But that was kind of interesting. And I'm dying to know the answer to this question, which is, who would call their child Peacock Bigger? That's just
Peacock Bigger.
Yeah, he's from Philadelphia.
Peacock was a surname. It was probably someone's surname that was carried on.
Yeah.
Well, that's good answer.
Hey, I got a fascinating topic. I want to thank the three of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
And by the way, wanted to mention that to commemorate the 75th anniversary of D-Day, June 6th, Smart Talk road trip to the Eisenhower Farm. Join us for the live broadcast. You can register at WITF.org. Like to see you there.